this week a Senate inquiry into gene patents is holding public hearings. The question is whether companies should be able to own genes which exist naturally in the body. Now, later in the program, we'll hear from Dr. Francis Gurry. The Geneva-based Australian is the Director General of the UN agency WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organisation. But first, to Luigi Palombi, an intellectual property lawyer and academic at the ANU. Luigi is highly critical of gene patents. He's attending the Senate Committee's public hearings throughout the week.
Well, the inquiry is looking at gene patents. Now, that has a very nebulous meaning in the sense that what is a gene patent, but it's specifically looking at patents that claim genetic materials or biological materials in various ways, either as the materials themselves and the uses of those materials in various medical and scientific ways.
And who will be appearing before this Senate inquiry? A bunch of lawyers and a bunch of scientists, presumably?
No, not actually. You'd be surprised. The Country Women's Association of New South Wales has filed a submission. There are a number of cancer groups that have filed submissions. The National Breast Cancer Foundation, for instance, Cancer Voices.
They presumably are making submissions for the very reason that this Senate inquiry, which was set up, which was as a result of a letter sent out mid-last year, wasn't it? Tell me about that very controversial letter.
Well, the letter was the typical sort of lawyers' letters that are sent out. It made demands. All the public laboratories in this country that were performing breast and ovarian cancer gene testing cease and desist within 7 days. The basis of the claim was that they were infringing 4 patents that had been granted to American company Myriad Genetics, and the Australian company Genetic Technologies was the exclusive licensee.
And tell me about this test which uses these 2 genes. What is this test used for?
It's to test whether there are specific gene mutations in the BRCA 1 and 2 gene. And if those mutations are there, then the results are forwarded on to the clinicians, and the clinicians have to make a diagnosis and then recommend a form of treatment to the patient.
So in practical terms, what was Genetic Technologies seeking in this letter, and what would have been the effect on the test providers and on the women seeking these tests if there had been compliance with the letter of demand?
Well, it means that they would have had the exclusive monopoly on gene testing in Australia. It would have meant that all of the laboratories, all hospitals that would have sent materials and tests to those laboratories would have been directed to send them to Genetic Technologies laboratories in Melbourne.
Genetic Technologies had obtained the Australian licence from US-based company Myriad for the exclusive use of the gene sequence in BRCA1 and BRCA2. And the July 2008 letter was in fact the second time the company had tried to assert its exclusive rights here in Australia. Back in 2002, it sent out similar letters, but backed down when the company attracted widespread criticism. At that point, it gifted its legal rights to the country. But last year, the corporation had a change of heart, and in July 2008 sent out a new batch of cease and desist letters. But again, there was an outcry, and again, the company backed down. It was this latest sequence of events concerning a genetic sequence that led to the Senate establishing an inquiry into gene patents.
Strictly speaking, the patent monopoly should only be granted in respect of something that is an invention. And that's one of the things that this inquiry is going to be looking at. You know, are genes in an isolated form, and by that I mean genes that have been removed from the human body or removed from their natural environments, are these inventions? And the scientific community seems to be pretty clear that they're not. And I'm certainly of the view, and I have been for many years as a patent lawyer, of the view that they are not inventions and cannot be inventions, because essentially they are identical or substantially identical to what exists in nature.
So you would argue that when scientists identify or isolate a gene or similar sort of material, they are discovering something that already exists. They are not inventing something, and therefore they are not deserving of an exclusive right, which is traditionally seen as a reward for inventiveness.
Well, that's correct. I mean, in short, a patent is about an invention, and if you don't meet that threshold, for whatever reason, you just don't have an entitlement to a patent.
Isn't in the modern day the test a little more complicated? You need to establish these days in order to get a patent that there is a new and practical use for the sequence that you've isolated or identified. That is evidence of inventiveness. There is a practical application sometimes.
Well, I don't think it's evidence of inventiveness. It's just evidence of further discovery. Merely linking an isolated gene to a particular function, whether it be in the form of the production of a hormone or linking it to a mutation which is associated with a particular disease, that's just no more than an extension of discovery. That's still not an invention.
And Luigi Palombi, the issue around gene patents is also currently before the courts in the USA as we speak. What's that case looking at?
Well, that's an interesting development and one that was a little unexpected, but the American Civil Liberties Union has sponsored an action, and it's been brought by a number of plaintiffs, including the Association for Molecular Pathology, the American College of Medical Genetics, the American Society for Clinical Pathology, and the College of American Pathologists, just to name a few, and there's also another, there's the Breast Cancer Action Group. These individuals want to challenge the myriad patents that have been granted in the United States over the BRCA1 and BRCA2 gene mutations.
The same gene mutations that were the subject of the controversy here in Australia.
Yes, pretty much the same patent.
What's the legal argument being put forward by the American Civil Liberties Union?
It's a two-prong attack. First, they're using patent grounds. They're saying, well, isolated genes are not biological materials that can be patented. They're not patentable subject matter under US patent law. And the second thing, they're saying this is a violation of the Constitution. And these are interesting arguments. This is the first time that they've been raised in the courts. But I have to say, already a rearguard action is being developed. I think Myriad are bringing a motion which is going to be heard in the United States District Court for the Southern District of New York, August the 12th. So they're going to be seeking to strike out the claim on the basis that these plaintiffs have no standing to bring the action.
Luigi Palombi, what do you believe are the real-world negative consequences of the granting of these kinds of patents?
The immediate negative effect is that you're granting a monopoly over something that really should be available to anyone to use. I mean, that's a basic premise of patent law, and the US Supreme Court has said that. You know, natural phenomena belong to no one, and they are reserved exclusively to none. And there's a very good reason for that, and that's because we want scientists and inventors really to be able to use these materials to actually make inventions. So the moment you grant monopoly rights over these very basic elementary materials, I don't mean by that they are simple, they're not, they're actually quite complex. But the moment you grant these patents over these materials, you actually hinder the ability of scientists and inventors, because they then have to seek permission, they have to find out whether they're plans of research are going to encroach on someone's territory. There are costs involved in all of that. It slows the whole process down. And in any event, ultimately, these things are just arguably not inventions.
There was a Canadian study a few years ago that concluded that there really was no evidence that research was being stymied because of these kinds of patents.
Yeah, well, I sort of question these sorts of studies. They usually ask glib questions, and they're very limited in scope in terms of the numbers of respondents that they seek information from. The truth is, we actually don't really know just how much these patents are impacting.
Stepping back and talking more generally about the sorts of genes which are now being patented here in Australia, what's the alternative? Can you think of a better system that would better balance the rights between the rights of the patent holders and others?
Well, I think we should just apply basic principles here. If you invent something using a genetic material or a protein, like a vaccine, for instance, or a form of treatment, a way of treating a gene malfunction and correcting the malfunction, if you can create something like that, something that doesn't exist in nature, and it achieves a new and useful result, and no one's done it before, then I think you're entitled to a patent. No one's arguing about that. But I think it's going way too far to simply grant the patents over something as simple as the gene itself.
Supporters of the current system point to the Gardasil vaccine, which was developed here in Australia by a Nobel Prize-winning team, and it's used to reduce the incidence of cervical cancer in young women. Supporters of the system say if it wasn't for patents, the vaccine could never have been developed here in Australia, and that's got to be acknowledged.
Well, you know, it might be the case and it might not be the case. I mean, we're not here to debate what happened with Gardasil, because Gardasil's in a totally different class. Professor Fraser and his team did something which was, in a sense, inventive. And if you look at the original claims, they weren't seeking to patent, you know, something that exists in nature. They actually had changed something that exists in nature to produce an immune response in humans. And it turns out, creates this permanent immunity against cervical cancer. Now, that's terrific. And it may be that without the patent system, they might not have got the money. But that's not an argument we're really having here.
You're saying we're talking about a different kind of patent in that case?
Yeah, we are. We're talking about something completely different. And in respect of the discovery processes, what generally is the case is that most of the discoveries that are made in terms of identifying a gene and linking it to disease or a function happens through the public university system, through public funding, because this is sort of basic research. It's not really the sort of applied research that companies are really interested in and are going to invest money in. They'll come in later on, but at the very basic level, we do really heavily rely on publicly funded research, and we need to acknowledge this.
I've got to put it to you, with, say, the BRCA1 gene and the BRCA2 gene, okay, the patents are over the genes themselves, but there is a real use, there is a real application. Knowing how those gene mutations work, that is extremely useful information for patients and for doctors. There is a use just in that knowledge.
Yeah, sure, there is, but that doesn't make it an invention. And in terms of using it, for example, to develop a diagnostic test, well, there's nothing inventive in that.
Didn't the isolation or the identification of BRCA1 and BRCA2 mean that that diagnostic test could be created and could be used, and that did have real-world outcomes? There was invention there.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. But that doesn't make it invention. That just means that someone out there discovered that there was a link between a gene and gene mutation and disease. That's great information, and we need to share that information. And someone went on and developed the test, but, you know, the step to develop that test was so elementary, so obvious, that it really lacks inventive steps. So I would argue that merely applying something like that in an elementary way, such as to make a diagnostic test, just doesn't cut the mustard, not in terms of patentable subject matter, but in terms of inventive step, which is a further requirement of patentability.
Luigi Palombi, intellectual property lawyer and academic at the ANU. Views on the issue are passionate and they are polarised. Yesterday at the Senate hearings, a cancer survivor pleaded, quote, "If you discover a treatment or cure, then patent that. Don't patent the gene, patent the cure." But leading medical research centre, the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute, told the hearing gene patents had never harmed the Institute's work or its ability to collaborate. A spokesman said patenting is an integral part of research and said, quote, "In order to maximise the invention reaching the clinic, you have to have sound intellectual property protection." Patent attorney Trevor Davies is a counsellor with the Australian Institute of Patent and Trademark Attorneys. Later this morning, he's appearing before the Senate inquiry hearing in Melbourne. No doubt he'll be grilled by the senators on his views about BRCA1 and BRCA2. Trevor Davies will tell them he believes it is appropriate for genetic technologies to have the legal rights it does.
I think it's clearly fair that it has those rights.
And do you think it's fair and appropriate for them to attempt to assert those rights in the way that they sought to?
Having a valid patent protection allows the patentee to assert its rights in the marketplace. The Australian Patent Office issued a patent on this invention, and the invention relies on the recognition of mutations in these genes that allow the detection of potential cancer risk. This sort of material and subject has been found to be patentable here in Australia and also overseas.
There's a lot of, I guess, questions around the social utility and the like, as well as the science. But just on that social utility question, there are a range of groups which have put in submissions to the current inquiry. One of them was the Country Women's Association, and it was saying, well, look, right now, women can receive these tests at a public laboratories. Those scans will be done without charge. But if the company asserted its legal rights, they would have charged something like $2,100 per test, and that would have been a big impost on the system. It wouldn't have been a public good for that to happen.
I think enforcement of patent rights is a commercial issue that really has to be taken up with the company involved. Having valid patent rights allows a company to assert its rights, but how it does it is really its own commercial option.
But you're saying if the system has granted such a patent, that it is appropriate for people to then seek to assert their rights?
It is a right granted by the Australian government when a patent issues for a particular technology.
Now, can we talk a little bit more about this distinction between inventions and discoveries? And you have people like Luigi Palombi who argue that sequences themselves, like in BRCA1 and BRCA2, should not be patented because they're not, in his mind, inventions. They're simply discoveries, the naming of something that already exists.
A lot of gene technology results from the observation of occurrence of a particular phenomenon and then the use of that for some useful and commercial benefit. So in the case of BRCA1 and 2, the recognition of those mutations really has allowed the development of tests for this particular disease.
But the actual patents, I think there were four of them, three of them were actually on the actual sequence, the gene sequence itself, rather than the tests.
The patents would cover off the isolated nucleic acid, or the sequence of, and including the sequence of that material. What's something important to recognise is that when gene patents were first issued, say around 20 years or so ago, there was very little knowledge about the molecular system, the importance of mutations in genes. And so that in the early days, relatively broad patents may have issued. But I think nowadays, with the state of knowledge, the likelihood of such broad patents issuing is quite low.
So you're saying that maybe the kind of patents which were issued around BRCA1 and BRCA2 might not be issued in this day and age?
Certainly with the knowledge that people have now with the sequencing of the human genome, the covering off of isolated genes per se would be quite difficult.
So you're saying that perhaps the BRCA1 and BRCA2 controversy doesn't reflect the issues at the heart of this wider debate around gene patenting?
No, I don't think it does.
What for you is at the heart of the framework that we have, and why do you say it's important to keep it?
The Australian patent law and patent laws of most countries allow the protection of gene-related patents. And for an invention to be patentable, it must be novel, involve an inventive step, and be useful. Now, research that results in useful clinical information can be patented, and the patent system in Australia has evolved to allow protection of these sort of new and emerging technologies.
Can you give examples of the kinds of benefits that you say flow from the current framework?
In order to commercialise a biotechnology-related invention, it requires a lot of effort, a lot of cost, and being able to protect that innovation makes it more likely that you can be able to successfully commercialise that particular innovation.
I guess, though, there's a distinction between identifying and isolating something that's always existed and that next step of actually doing something which is actually truly inventive, truly innovative. Mm. And I guess that's where that line is drawn, is where the dispute is in this whole issue.
Well, patent law has evolved to actually recognise that fact, and new genetic information or new uses of known technology or known compounds are clearly patentable.
Can you give examples of where you regard that these kind of gene patents have been very effective in promoting development of treatments?
An example of a similar patent is for the cystic fibrosis gene. Now, that was patented in Australia back in 1990, and the owners of that patent license the technology to many people. There's no exclusive licensing arrangement, and the work carried out by those researchers allowed a very useful and diagnostic product that is available at a cost to everybody.
The actual gene itself is patented?
The mutated gene, yes, is covered in its isolated form and uses thereof.
So you're saying that's really quite analogous to the BRCA1 and BRCA2?
Yeah, that's an example. But the main difference is that there's not an exclusive company involved in the testing for that particular gene. That's been made more freely available by the owners of that patent.
Well, should we be allowing that discretion in the hands of the patent holder? Wouldn't it be better to have some kind of system where they couldn't play hardball if they so chose?
There are systems available to either challenge the rights of a particular patent or challenge the commercial use of technology within the patent system or outside the patent system. So it's really looking at the commercialization, not necessarily the patent protection per se.
I understand that the Australian Law Reform Commission looked at this issue back in 2004. What did it conclude?
It concluded that the Patents Act should not be changed to preclude the patentability of gene-related technologies. It confirmed that the system was sound and no changes were recommended with the actual Patents Act.
What was its fundamental reasoning in that regard?
Fundamental reasoning was that the patent system was playing an important part in the industry here in Australia, and that it is difficult to start precluding technologies within a patenting system. The Patents Act is quite flexible here in Australia, and the Patent Office and the courts have the ability to develop or to improve the sorts of things that can be patented as technology changes over time.
Patent attorney Trevor Davies, who's appearing later this morning before the Senate inquiry into gene patenting. I'm Damien Carrick and you're listening to The Law Report on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, and also available for download from our website at abc.net.au/rn/lawreport. Debates around the pros and cons of gene patents are not confined to this country. Australian Dr. Francis Gurry is the Director General of the UN agency WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organisation. He says the debate around gene patents is an ongoing one in many jurisdictions, and as head of an international organisation, he can't endorse a particular approach.
We stand in a neutral position, actually, because internationally this is an area that is left for each country to decide its own policy.
As you say, different countries have different approaches to this. I understand that the major economies like Brazil and Argentina don't allow for the patenting of genes. Do they have viable biotech industries?
It's a good question. I mean, that's one consideration you always have to have is what are you doing to your home industry if you are going to exclude patent protection? And the other is how are you going to relate to your major trading partners? Because if you're not protecting things that they regard to be extremely important, then they're obviously going to regard you as a less hospitable environment in which to invest. I think that the life science industries in Argentina and Brazil are not perhaps at the top of the world.
Unlike Australia, which is?
Where I think we have a very viable, and medical science in particular, extremely important, you know, research base.
There's a fascinating interplay here of science, societal benefit or public policy and economics. There are a whole range of extremely important factors at play in this debate, aren't there?
Absolutely. And I mean, I think you've got to balance incentives. You've got, on the one hand, you want to encourage investment in these areas, and sometimes the investment is extremely heavy. Let's take a new drug, for example. The pharmaceutical industry says it's about $1.3 billion to bring a new drug to the market. So you need to be able to protect that investment or no, nobody will make it. On the other hand, we're talking about inventions that improve the quality of life and improve health. So you really want them to be available on the most broad basis. And that's the counterweight, if you like. And finding the balance between those two is the trick.
But I guess the $64 million question is something a discovery or is it an invention? And of course, here in Australia, the Senate inquiry, we're having it because of the controversy over the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes.
That's right.
You know, where do you draw the line between discovery and invention? But critics say just understanding what the gene sequence is does not in itself constitute an invention.
Yes, that's what they say. But of course, the gene sequence doesn't occur on its own in isolation in nature. To get it, you have to identify it and you have to be able to find a way of isolating it in order to make it useful. So that's the other side of the coin, that it does require some human intervention and some human ingenuity to get to the point where you can use it.
To name it.
Yes, to name it and also to use it, to be able to use it in a diagnostic tool.
To use it to help women identify their risk profile for ovarian and breast cancer.
That's right. And I think what we get in the pharmaceutical industry often is a question of market failure and the need to have some government intervention. You know, so it's one thing to create the incentives. The patent law only goes so far. So you can create the incentives through the patent to investment in that area by giving the property right. But then you have other policy instruments that you can use, like competition policy or pricing controls, which will ensure the widespread diffusion of the social benefit of the invention.
So you're saying that it's up to the regulators to make sure that the property right is ameliorated or diluted to a point where the societal costs are not huge.
That's right, used in a responsible way. I think that's right. That's one approach that you can adopt. The regulators can make sure that this new invention is made available on a widespread basis and one that is affordable, especially to people.
Yeah, coming back to BRCA1 and BRCA2, there's the distinction between the discovery and the invention, and people say, look, all you're doing is identifying what already is. You're not taking the next step, which is developing a treatment. So, say with the Gardasil vaccine, where something was identified and then it was manipulated. With BRCA1 and BRCA2, all it is identifying what is in nature.
I think that's right, and I think we're seeing this tension because, of course, science and technology are merging and technology is going deeper into science and people are being able to commercialise elements that were once considered pure science. It's a question of where you draw the line, I think, and that's a very, very difficult question. It's going to be with us increasingly in the life sciences, I think.
Is there a danger, though, that providing these patents then restricts the research?
Yeah, you take it out for the purpose for which the patent was granted. So in this instance, I think it was as a diagnostic kit. So I think that there the main question is the social availability of that.
But do you ever get
research?
But do you ever get patents which mean that research is restricted? And that is one of the arguments generally.
I think it's a terribly important thing, and we don't want that. You know.
But does it happen?
I think so. Well, look, I think the views are divided. Frankly, there's not enough protection of innovation is bad, and too much is bad. So you have to find the balance. And on this one, I can't unfortunately express an opinion because it's something that the Australian government's going to have to take a view on. But that balance is what we need.
Dr. Francis Gurry, Director General of the UN agency WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organisation. He's in Australia this week. And you can hear a second part of our interview with Dr. Gurry at our website. He talks about how China's economic rise and climate change are both set to transform the international intellectual property framework. That's the Law Report for this week. Thanks to producer Anita Barrow and to technical producer Joel Church. If you'd like to read a transcript, listen to the program online, download it onto your MP3 player, you can do all of those things at our website at abc.net.au/rn/lawreport.